Hi.
Hi, John.
It's Friday, which is great, but then it's tomorrow Saturday.
Yeah.
I have this welling anxiety about leaving.
Well, who's leaving who?
Yeah, I mean, good question.
Some of us are leaving you.
Well, I'm leaving too.
Well, this is a poem.
Yeah, that's a good question. Who's leaving? But Holden will be here. And we'll be back.
Yeah.
Does anybody know the history of this?
Was it England, and it had something to do with the anti-proliferation of Israel?
Yeah. Good. Anybody know more than that? That's awesome. Nobody even usually gets that far.
I thought it was just on the front of
t-shirts.
Yeah, right. That's where it originated, on the front of t-shirts. A little bunch of pine cones over there. Yeah, it was not Nixon. Gerald Holcomb was the designer in 1958 in Britain. It was the British Nuclear Disarmament Movement. They were marching on Trafalgar Square. And he came up with this design. And the meaning behind it, do we have any old Navy vets in the group? Anyone that worked on the flight deck? You know, the semaphores, the flags?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You put your flags like this, and it's N for nuclear.
Oh.
Put your flags like this, and it's D for disarmament.
Oh.
You overlay them, and you turn them into a stick figure, and you put a circle around them, and you got that.
Oh, that's cool.
And Gerald also said that it reminded him of a man in despair, like this. And so when you see that, it's got that history, which I think is pretty interesting.
So how soon after World War II did that develop? 1948?
58 was the march. And then it, of course, was adopted by the American peace activists, the hippies.
Yeah, me.
You? Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's yeah, me, if I had been born a little bit earlier, I think I'm a too late hippie in a lot of ways. But sometimes when we see the image, I worry that it, you know, the image also carries a lot of baggage, I think. And so sometimes you put this up and it, yeah, there's the magic again. Thanks. I can't believe it took me that long to figure out how the lights went on yesterday. I get focused, I think. You know, sometimes I worry if I walk into the wrong crowd and we put this up. I think the meaning of peace is a lot deeper than just this symbol. And I think the conversation should be a lot richer. But sometimes I think it gets sidetracked when people see this. And one example is this gentleman, Dan Gallagher. Actually, he lives in Missoula, Montana, and we saw him on the way out here. The day before we got here, we spent the night in Missoula, met him for a beer down by the river. There was some music going on, and got to see him. Dan is a Vietnam War veteran, and he talks pretty extensively in his interview about, you know, feeling like, you know, he'd just come out of high school and he was going to go serve his country, and his understanding of service to country was that you come back and they give you a parade on the 4th of July and all cheer for you and say thanks. And instead, he said, it came home at midnight to an empty bus station, and the next people I saw were calling me a baby killer and spitting in my face. So he said when he saw the peace symbol, he didn't think about people who wanted to have a conversation about nonviolence. He just felt like people were giving him the finger. So that was his understanding of peace. He also talks a lot about being in the military and his idea of peace being to have his buddy's back, to know that his buddy had his back, and to have that sort of really tight-knit community. But here's the interesting thing. Dan was the head of the American Legion in Missoula, you know, leading the Veterans Day ceremonies, Memorial Day ceremonies. And he wound up meeting Betsy Mulligan Dowd, who is the head of the Jeanette Rankin Peace Center in Missoula, Montana. The veterans community and the peace community aren't always peaceful, right? And a lot of that, I think, comes out of that history from the Vietnam War era. And hopefully we're learning that disagreeing with policy doesn't have to mean hating the people who implement policy, and that we can find a way to get past that. So Betsy ran the Peace Center, and she thought, I saw Betsy last week too. I'm going to just reach out to Dan and start having a conversation, see if we can bridge some of these divides. This is the pragmatism of real peacemaking in my mind. And they started getting to know one another. They eventually figured out that they had a lot in common. There's actually a documentary film that my friend made of these two called Beyond the Divide. Eventually, Betsy invited Dan to speak at Peace Day ceremonies, and Dan invited Betsy to speak at Memorial Day ceremonies, and they found some common ground. And Betsy says, I know exactly what the peace sign means to Dan, but on my 50th birthday, Dan gave me a pair of peace earrings because he knows it's important to me. So when I got together with them, they were talking about, I said, what's the latest news in Missoula? And they said, a bunch of us folks got together and decided we should help resettle some refugees, and it's caused a bit of a stink in the town. She said, then I got to thinking, so Betsy rides a Harley, and she does kickboxing, and she runs the Peace Center, and so she's really about trying different things. And she said, I got to thinking about it, and we invited all of these refugees here, and we didn't really ask the whole community to be involved in the process. We went ahead and did it, so of course maybe some people are ticked off. So when the protests started down at the county courthouse and at the city hall about that, she said she decided to just go out there and hang out with them. So she'd ride her Harley up and she'd wade into the middle of the protests and she'd say, you know, this is kind of my thing and I got it started. She said, tell me what you're angry about. And she just started engaging in conversation. And again, I think it would be really easy to say, oh, those dumb people over there, they're racist, they don't get it, whatever. But she decided she needed to engage them, to start that conversation, to keep them going. So that's the real pragmatism that I think is awesome in the pursuit of peace. I'm just going to share a few of these stories again. These stories, in my mind, have a real focus on transformation, on forgiveness, on grace. And when I think about peace, my favorite question to ask people is, tell me a time when you saw a great example of peace, because that kind of brings it down to earth and turns it into a real and practical thing. Hashim Garrett grew up in Brooklyn. He says that as a kid, he got shuffled around into different schools, and he wound up getting picked on. He wasn't the biggest kid, and he was afraid of these kids who were picking on him, right? He was filled with fear, and he finally came to the conclusion that the only way to escape that fear was to befriend those kids who were picking on him. Well, those kids wound up making some bad choices. They went down the path of gangs, and Hashim followed them right along. He said it didn't all start right away. He said, you know, first we'd skip a few classes, and then we'd go in and we'd steal the candy bar out of the store. And he said, before you knew it, we were carrying guns and rolling people on the street. And he said, for him, there was nothing more powerful than everybody being afraid of him. He said, when I was a good kid, nobody paid attention to me. When I was the bad kid, everybody knew my name. And that was intoxicating. And he also said that there was absolutely nothing that could have derailed him from that process, except something traumatic. And when he was 15 years old, he knew he wasn't getting along with the guys in the gang, and they came over to his house and they called him outside one day, and he went outside and they shot him. Bullets went through his back, through his spine, he was paralyzed from the waist down. And he said, when he was laying on the sidewalk, that desire to be the tough kid all just went away. Now Hashim goes around and works with at-risk youth in high schools to tell them not to do the same things that he did. But Hashim's perspective is simply filled with grace. You know, he said he doesn't hold any malice towards those people that shot him. He was in the same place. He was making the same sort of choices. He says that, in fact, he wouldn't be where he is today. He wouldn't be sort of the mature adult married with a couple of great kids if he hadn't been shot. He said, I'd probably be in prison somewhere. But he says his goal is to love the people who will not show him love and to forgive the people who will not give him forgiveness. Yeah. Yeah. That's what we can control, right? We can't control what happens to us. We can control how we respond. When I was bringing my exhibit out to New York University, I don't know, a couple years ago now, when was Sandy Hook? Was it 2 years? 1.5?
3 years.
Yeah. Well, whatever it is, I was bringing my exhibit out, and I drove right past Newtown, Connecticut. I was taking the scenic route, I think, right after that happened, like a month after. And we went past the exit, and there are candles in the snow, and there are little flags for each of the people who had died. And it got really quiet in the van. And I realized I wanted to talk to somebody who had been affected by large-scale public violence. Right? I wanted to have that conversation and find out where there could be peace in that. But I knew I didn't want it to be Sandy Hook because it was really fresh and new, and I felt like all the families were being pulled out by the media, being beaten up with these questions and used in this debate. So when I was going down to Oklahoma City a little bit later that year, I connected with Bud Welch. And Bud lost his only daughter in the Oklahoma City bomb. She had just graduated in 95 from Marquette University. She was fluent in 5 languages. She got hired as a translator for the Social Security Administration in the Murrell Building in Oklahoma City. And 4 months later, Timothy McVeigh blew it up. So Bud fell apart, right? Of course he did. He became an alcoholic. He lost his businesses. He really wanted nothing more than for Timothy McVeigh to fry. Just get the guy off the earth and let me try to go on with my life. Until he saw Timothy McVeigh's father on a news clip on TV. And he looked at him and he said, that guy looks as wrecked as I am. Right? His world fell apart on the same day my world fell apart. And he reached out to him. Not right away, but eventually. He went over to the McVeigh house. He sat at the kitchen table with Bill McVeigh. They're sitting, all the family pictures are up on the wall, including Timothy McVeigh. And he said, that's when I realized I didn't want Tim to die. So Bud started working against the execution of Timothy McVeigh. He didn't succeed. Right? McVeigh was executed pretty quickly, as these things go. But now Bud goes around the world working against capital punishment, having realized that for him, he got no sense of peace. He got no relief from the loss of one more life. And he said, that's the great lie that the prosecutors tell you. Right? They say, oh, you get the death penalty and then you'll be able to go on with your life. No. He said, I was re-victimized over again when I had to face this. And Bud said, of course, there were a lot of other families that were really mad at him when he was working against the execution of Timothy McVeigh. They said, how dare you? We need justice for our kids. But after the execution, he said, those same families came up to me and said, you know, you're probably right. Didn't do anything for them either. Those stories of transformation, forgiveness, I don't even know how I would begin to respond to a thing like that. But it's empowering and it's encouraging for me to see that in other people. Kim Book, met her in Delaware. She lost her daughter to murder. Her daughter was about 20 years old. This is about 20 years ago that it happened. And really, what Kim needed for healing was to be able to meet the person who committed this crime. Levon was his name. She needed to be able to see where he was in prison. She needed to understand those things. But there's no system in place for doing that. Right? You know, the justice system we have is really focused on the state. You know, the state has been harmed through this murder, so let's rectify the process with this punishment. There's not a lot of infrastructure in place for the victim of the crime to heal. So she started an organization in Delaware called Victims Voices Heard. It's a restorative justice program, and the goal is to connect victims of violence with the person who committed the crime, to try to build some understanding, to try to build some acceptance and responsibility for the crime that was committed, so that both parties can move forward. And she says that when she was in the courtroom, she had the chance to read a victim's impact statement. And she wasn't supposed to address LaVon directly, but it turns out she did. And she turned to him and she said, you know, the day you moved in, or the day you murdered my daughter, you moved into my life. You know, you picked up your suitcase and you came into my life and you're never going to leave. She said, I want you to know that I want good things for you. You know, and she went through this long list and she said, I forgive you for what happened. And she said the moment she forgave him, it felt like she took off this huge fur coat. Right, that forgiveness really doesn't do anything for LaVon. He could take it or leave it. But that forgiveness affects Kim. Right, and that's a thought that always lived in a foggy sense in the back of my mind, but I never really had it articulated well until I had that conversation with Kim. The great irony is that Kim Book started this restorative justice project, and she's helped over 50 people, 50 families meet the person who committed the crime. But one of the requirements is that the perpetrator accept responsibility and express remorse. LaVon has never done either one. So for herself, she's never been able to move forward with that process. But she says helping other families do it has been a healing process for her. I met Maham Khan at Harper College in Chicago. She started there as a first-year student in 2001. She was Muslim, but her faith was really personal. She never really talked about it very much. When she got to college, she thought, she needed something to help beef up her resume. She needed to show some leadership, get involved in some organizations. So she joined the Muslim Student Association. And somehow at the first meeting, she was elected as the president. So she was a little bit outside of her comfort zone, right? But she thought, okay, how bad can this be? She said, we'll have pizza on Tuesday nights. We'll discuss Quranic verses on Thursday nights. How bad could it be? Well, a couple weeks later, 9/11 happened.
Oh, boy.
And all of a sudden, she was way outside of her comfort zone. Right, she was all of a sudden at the head of an organization that became one of the most scrutinized organizations on campus. And she was really uncomfortable. And when that happens, I think we have two choices. You know, we can either face it head on or we can run away when we're uncomfortable. She decided to face it head on. She started organizing interfaith dialogue sessions on campus because she figured out really intuitively that when people walk by one another in the hall and mutter things under their breath, well, that builds conflict and tension. But when they sit down face to face and have a conversation, that reduces tension. And sure enough, it did over time. There were some really difficult conversations. There were some really challenging debates that went on. But as these conversations continued, it helped reduce the tension on campus. And it happened and it worked because people chose to stay at the table. Right? People chose to remain even through the difficult conversations. And I think our temptation sometimes is when things get difficult to stand up and walk away from the table. So the question is, when things get rough, will we stick around? And I think I've got one last story, and this is Penina Bowman in Atlanta, who was in Auschwitz. Again, I guess I shared a Holocaust survivor story from the first book. But that narrative is so compelling to me, and that history is running so late to me. These people aren't going to be around much longer, and I think it's really important that these stories are recorded. And her story is really, really fascinating. She met one of the soldiers who had liberated the camp, fell in love with him. She shipped down to Israel. She wasn't sure where he was, but she kept sending him letters. When she took the boat down to Israel, she was supposed to just bring the clothes she was wearing, but she took a piece of parachute and tucked it inside of her clothes, and while she was waiting to hear back from him in Israel, she sewed a wedding dress in hopes that he would get back in touch, and in fact he did. And they got married, and she wore the parachute dress for their wedding. But she says when she moved to America, so many of the fellow Holocaust survivors that she knew were bitter. I mean, it makes sense, right? Look what happened to you. She said, but she decided that she wouldn't hate anybody. She just made that conscious choice. She said, because she saw so many of her friends destroying their lives with hate. And really, our idea when we hate somebody is to destroy them. She said, but of course that circles around and it destroys us instead. I have to go back to my notes. I forgot where I was going to go next with that idea. Sorry. More than anything in these stories, I think, is that impresses me is this ability to heal. The ability, I think sometimes when we think of the notion of peace, we imagine that we can be more peaceful if, you know, if I was healthier, if I was happier, if I had enough money. We make all of these reasons, but some of these stories in particular inspire me that we can simply make the choice to respond to a peaceful message. As we think about some of the ways that we need to heal in our country right now, what are some of the things that come to mind for you?
Authenticity of character.
Oh, say more about that.
I'm just saying in this political realm that we're in, looking, that people can be, not be afraid to be authentic.
Yeah.
And be in touch with their authentic selves. You know, get rid of those barriers that we put up that we want people to see.
Yeah.
And just be honest about, you know, I'm looking for somebody who can be honest about their shortcomings. And just say, hey, you know, I'm going to give it my best shot.
Right. Yeah. Right. What else? What are some of the other things that we... Yeah, tell me.
Well, I think that over the years, especially in the last maybe 15 years, there's been such a divide where each side looks at the other as the other and demonizes. You know, and part of it has to do with these labels that we've given ourselves. Conservative, liberal. That doesn't really say anything about who I am and what I believe. And when people really talk about those things, they find that they're a lot closer together than they realize.
But when we hear the label, we attach all sorts of baggage to it.
Yes.
And it usually swings out to the extreme end of that spectrum.
So if we can stop branding one another with those labels and looking at people that don't think exactly like me, and no one does, you know, think exactly like you, as the other, you know. I think that is a really, it's going to be a really tough process because the media supports and thrives on.
There's a whole industry, there's a whole profession in righteous indignation and pointing out how stupid the other side is.
And anger, and yes. And until we eliminate the name calling and start to actually speak to one another in dialogue, that is just going to get worse.
Yeah. One sec, I don't know if any of you saw it yesterday or the day before, Brenna was wearing a t-shirt and it was a big word cloud. Mm-hmm. And it was black, white, Muslim, Christian, Republican, Democrat. But out of the center of that word cloud was reversed the word human. Mm-hmm. You know, we are all of these labels, but at the end of the day, all of us are human. Mm-hmm. I like that. Anyway,
I was just going to say, and social media has not helped the problem, it's made it worse.
Yeah, and the splintering of our media so that you can find exactly the news source that tells you exactly that you're right all the time and you only have to listen to that message, I think is really damaging. I think we need to be intentional about hearing the other side. We need to be intentional about hearing other people's narratives.
getting to a table and staying there.
Getting to a table and staying there. Yeah, sometimes you might have to invite yourself to a table.
But without anger.
But without anger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clearly we're all thinking politically around here, and I think a lot of it also needs to begin, I know personally for me, within my own family, because I have very different views than my parents and my brother. And how do you begin those initial conversations peacefully? Because there's times where I'm just terrified, I don't talk about it, because it's just like, rah!
Yeah.
But how do you, you know, globally, we can go to our favorite, you know, news, or we can go to social media, we surround ourselves with friends that think just like we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when you go home to these people with whom you grew up, or these people that brought you to life, how do you engage in a peaceful way, in an intentional, authentic way, and hear each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really tempting to go to the most divisive issue first. You know, because that's all front of mind for all of us. But I think it's really important to start somewhere else, somewhere a little gentler, you know, and somewhere that you know you have history and common ground and can return to if you need to. I think that's the thing that Betsy said about her and Dan, the peace activist and the Vietnam vet, that they had sort of a core set of values from family and upbringing and what was important to them and family and so on. And they always knew that when things were getting a little too tough, they could retreat to that and sort of, what's the right word? Nurture their commonality before all of their differences would sort of splinter that relationship. And so they're very intentional about that. And when things start getting heated, they're like, well, let's back up and return here and move that conversation into some place where you can find some accord, you know, and then come back to them another time. You know, race issues in our country are a bit of a big deal at the moment. And this is kind of a new model for a piece of my mind that we started doing. Earlier this summer, Karen and I went up to Washington, D.C. for the Sojourners Summit. You know, Sojourners, Jim Wallace, good social justice folks. And I had brought my exhibit there last year, but we didn't want to repeat and do that same thing. So this year I suggested to him, I said, why don't we create a new body of work from the conference? Why don't we sit down and photograph and interview in a small way, not hour-long interviews, but just small little snippets. All of the people who are at the conference, or some of the people who are at the conference, and create a body of work. And so Jim Wallace's most recent book, I think it's America's Original Sin, it's all based on race and race relations in America. So their conference was focused on race. And so we decided to shift our question away from what does peace mean to you to when was the first time you saw issues of race in your own life. We wanted to keep things tweetable. Actually, we wanted them to fit on the photograph so we could put overlay the words on the image. Happens to be about 25 words, which is kind of tweetable. I really resist exploring the world by bumper sticker and slogan, but this wound up being a pretty effective tool where people could share their stories. And I guess I just want to share a few of them with you. Again, this is about 4 minutes, and we've got a little bit of music that I'll play. And just spend some time with these stories and see what people shared with us. Give me a second, I gotta get my music going. Thoughts?
Wow.
I liked when we got to the slant eye one because it took it from black and white to it's, you know, the gamut.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the Scandinavian one.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't have a race.
I grew up like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What traditions do I have? I'm a plain old white guy.
Yeah. Many white people probably don't even think about that, but if they did, they would say the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think the Scandinavian had it right in the first place. I don't think there's race.
I think there's ethnicity, and people who are talking about having a problem with race, or they got a problem with ethnicity, but they're labeling a whole section of the world, and they're. They're looking at one attribute, a general attribute, for a whole segment of the world.
Yeah.
How are you distinguishing between race and ethnicity?
Race, I think, is something that had been defined for reasons of, to make things easier to classify of people for commerce or for political reasons. Ethnicity is something, it's your heritage. It's how you grew up, what your traditions are, what's been passed on to you. Race isn't important.
So if black children go around with whites long enough, they'll become white? Is that what you're saying? They live long enough with them?
No. I'm saying they will pick up some of the traditions. Everybody doesn't have the same traditions. Everybody's unique with that. There's only, you have a lot of, people are more the same than they are different.
So my understanding, and I struggle with that distinction myself. My understanding is that race is a social construct. Ethnicity is more rooted in heritage and genetics.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
Yeah. I think my father-in-law, God bless him, one of the best people in the world. And Karen has the same conversation. So the fact that she's not here doesn't mean I can talk differently, but Wally will see a news article about an African American person who committed a crime, and he'll go, figures.
Oh.
And then he'll watch 10 news articles about a white person who has committed a crime, and it won't register at all. Right? We walk around with a preconceived set of ideas in our head. And we work really hard to find the evidence that supports that. And we work just as hard or harder to ignore everything that refutes that.
Well, that's what your one guy, the guy that said in school, that because, that when he was in fifth grade, I forget what it was, but.
This guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, my actions were judged differently than my white classmates in all areas. So there's a gentleman by the name of Brian Stevenson who runs an organization called the Equal Justice Initiative. Anyone familiar with that? Equal Justice Initiative works against unrightful incarceration. He's a lawyer by trade, and his organization is a law organization, and they'll come in when people have had bad representation and try to get their cases revisited. But Brian, African-American male, will go often into the courtroom to prepare before the trial begins, and he's sitting at the defendant's table, and he said he can't count the number of times the judge has looked at him and said, "Excuse me, sir, you're going to have to go outside until your lawyer gets here."
Oh, no.
Right? Because if you're an African American male in the courtroom, you must be that guy. Right? So he talks about. How much of his energy is spent making white people feel okay around him. That there's this predetermination of dangerousness and threat that he has to overcome from the minute he walks into the room. Yeah.
The fact is that quote there, and in particular, in the back of my mind, I've been thinking all along the way that as we talk about peace, P-E-A-C-E, that there is no such thing without justice. And yeah. It's very clear in the scriptures, the righteousness which is the same as justice, tzedakah, and shalom, peace, each other, in the Psalms.
Mm.
They go together. You can't have peace You know, what it actually ends up being is, without justice, it ends up just being a form of oppression. You keep certain people quiet,
yeah.
Make them slaves or something, and you call it peace, like the Pax Romana.
Right,
they
peace by the sword.
Lots of people,
yeah.
And they called it peace. But you can't have real peace, shalom, until you get the justice.
Right.
And that goes not just race, but it goes economics and everything else. The whole little.
Yep. So then we're talking about the difference between negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace being the absence of violence. Pax Romana can do that, except for the threat of the sword. Positive peace is an environment where all people can flourish, where they have justice, where there is equity, where they can have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? And, go ahead. I saw a hand back here.
So, Palestine is a very good example of that, where there is no justice with the lack of violence, for example. And so, even when there is no violence, the Palestinians are still living under oppression.
Yeah, they're living in an untenable situation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and until that is resolved, we're never going to see peace. There.
My favorite was Jim Wallace. His statement about the pastor, his pastor.
Mm-hmm.
So when one of the times we came back from Palestine, and we went to our church and talked to the pastor about doing a presentation, and he said, "Fine, as long as you're not political." So it was exactly this, and my response was, "Is telling the truth political?"
Jesus was
political. Which I didn't get an answer.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus was just moderately political, yes,
yeah.
In fact. So. You know, I mean, to me, the entire Bible is a lesson in how we get along with one another, mm-hmm. how we treat one another. You know, you look at the commandment, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Well, how does that relate to racism? You know, if you are saying things that are untrue about an entire group of people, are you not, in fact, bearing false witness against those people? You know, I think you could dissect any one of those commandments, and we are, in fact, being instructed with how to live together. Yeah, Tony.
I want to go back to the ethnicity for just a minute, because mm-hmm. as this country grew, we had these different groups, Italians, the Irish, Japanese, those groups were looked down upon as they came in as a group ethnically.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference was, and it was made very clear in World War II, those groups looked like what America considered, they didn't look different from the white leaders.
Right.
But the Japanese did.
Yes, yeah, so
the
we can
Germans
put them all in internment camps, but we're not
Germans
putting the Italians and the Germans and the Russians in internment
right,
camps.
Right, right. And yeah. So I understand that what he's saying about ethnicity, because within each racial group, there's a lot of ethnicities, but it's we have to get past looking different from one another.
Yeah. Who are our current scapegoats?
Yeah.
The Arabs.
Muslims.
Yeah.
Yeah, I with my first book, I think I told you I didn't have many Muslim people in my circle, but I knew that voice was going to be important. And I think for me, I've come to realize that the greatest gift a piece of my mind can be is to help amplify voices that otherwise might not be heard. You know, that's what I can do. With my tool set. So if there are voices that I've heard, so I needed to include Muslim voices, so I reached out. Then I eventually went on to do a whole copycat project like this for the Minnesota Historical Society of 50 Muslims in Minnesota. Turns out they're not a monolithic block. You know, some of them came here 7 generations ago. Some of them just got here. Some of them, are doctors and engineers, and some of them are cab drivers. So there's an incredible range of diversity, but you wouldn't necessarily know that from some of the political.
Well, in the Southwest, there are Hispanics whose roots go back you know, in America or in this continent long before the pilgrims got here.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, if you're going to build the wall, should we put it where the Mexican border used to be and give them back most of Texas and Arizona? At what point do you want to draw the line, right? And where do you draw the line? If we start talking about immigration, you know, the net flow of people from Mexico to here is negative right now.
Exactly.
Has been for the last 5 to 10 years, right? Economic factors are in place. And so if we want to talk about security, you can build a fence as tall as you want, but people are still, if they're desperate, they're going to find creative ways to get here, right? You can build that fence as tall as you want, but if you want to be truly secure, what if we spread prosperity and success and security to other nations, right? If Syria falls apart, of course people are going to flee and they have to go somewhere. Oh, all of a sudden we don't want Syrians in Missoula. Well, guess why they left? So if we can take action to make Syria secure in this big world, which is getting smaller every day, I think that means my neighbor needs to be secure as well.
How are we doing on time? We have 10 minutes.
I'm not sure what... this is Inez Torres Davis. She's the head of the Women's ELCA. Thingamajiggy? I know so little about the structure of my church.
Women of the ELCA.
Inez is the president of it. She was also at the Sojourner Summit. And now I think my exhibit's going to go to the Women's of the ELCA conference, which is in Minneapolis next year. Next summer.
Okay. It's interesting. She didn't seem to catch on for a good while that the dirty hands was about her color. Is that right? Is that what she said?
Yeah. She said she didn't really understand until she was an adult. What was going on?
We have odd things. Like if I can do this quickly. So I grew up in Los Angeles. It was the old Sober Dame Church. The church where I was baptized, they eventually sold that because the neighborhood was changing. They didn't feel comfortable with the neighborhood changing. And so they sold it to black Lutherans. So then we built a new place, you know, there. And then years later, I'm now back to that synod called district. And I'm on the Senate Council, and there's a young woman in the group I'm in, and we're discussing things and telling her story, blah, blah, blah. And it ends up, she grew up in that church where I was baptized, and she didn't know that there was any white Lutherans until she was like 18 or 19.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, we miss the big picture so often. You know, we miss the mark of what our potential is. You know, my church leased space to a Russian congregation so they could come in, and they would come in on, Friday nights and do their services. And at the time, I was in our church choir, and I also knew that they had a church choir, and I said to the choir director, oh, wouldn't it be awesome if we invited them to our Sunday and we could practice a couple of times and we'd sing something in English and Russian, and you know. And they said, I don't know if they'd be open to that. I said, well, did you ask them? And they said, no, it's a hard conversation. I'm like, really, how hard is that? And then eventually our church voted to no longer lease it to the Russian congregation because I guess some people felt like the carpet was a little cluttered or they didn't put the chairs back
in. Oh, yeah, right.
And that seemed to be such an overwhelming burden that we couldn't overcome it. So I think we miss the mark. We miss the big picture sometimes. In fact, I do too. Where is Janelle? Beautiful portrait, I love this. Janelle had two stories to tell me. This was one of them, her other story, and she couldn't decide which one to do, so she was asking for my input. And she said, the other story was that she remembers when she was in elementary school, someone was saying, what's the difference between you and me? And she said, well, we can do our hair in a lot cooler ways than you can. And her friend started crying and ran away. And she felt kind of bad about that. And I'm not sure exactly what I was trying to articulate. I said, but I love this quote because it feels like something that a dumb white person would say sometimes. And then, But how it came out of my mouth, it wound up sounding like I was calling her grandma stupid. And I saw this look in her eye, and I thought, with all that I'm trying to do in the world, I am right now in this moment doing exactly the opposite, and I felt horrible. And so I sort of stumbled through the rest of the process. We did this portrait, and at that point, it would have been really easy to say, I hope I don't bump into Janelle again. But what I chose to do was seek her out, and I got this ready, and I knew she was in a session, and I waited outside with my laptop, and I said, hey, come here, I want to talk to you. And I explained to her, I said, I don't know what happened, but what I articulated to you is not even something that I believe. And I articulated it so poorly, and I went against what I'm trying to do with this project, and I just want to ask your forgiveness. And she and I continued to email back and forth, and it was, I mean, there was resolution, and there was a hug, and everything was good. She said, I didn't expect to have that kind of awkward conversation at a conference about race, but thank you for pursuing it. And I think when we get in those moments, it gets so uncomfortable sometimes that we just want to quit. But again, to stay at the table and say, look, I'm sorry I said something stupid, because people always say something stupid, right? But we can recover from that, too. And when we do, there's some depth and possibility in that.
And it's an odd twist in that. Don't trust white people, but you can trust Jews.
Yeah, right? Huh. Were the Jews, in fact, more involved with the Underground Railroad than Christians? I don't know.
I don't know.
Where are we? Does anybody have a story that they, when they have sort of become painfully aware of race issues? Yeah.
I was a victim of racial backlash, I think. When I was in third grade, my best friend is black. Mm-hmm. And for some unknown reason, he started beating up on me, and he had a lot of black friends around him. I never did figure out why.
Hmm.
Later, I expected I knew that he was trying to...
Frustration coming out in your direction?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably he had been a victim of racism, and I was white, and he decided that I was part of the problem.
Yeah.
I have a question on that. I mean, were your parents involved?
No.
Did they know what happened?
I don't recall. Don't recall.
I'm just curious how, you know, that would have come home to the parents, with the parents, how they would have reacted.
I think they were, because we were next door neighbors, and our families talked to each other. Mm. We were friends with each other.
But you just let it slide, and...
I have to say, I don't recall. I know that we were friends, and up to that point.
Up to that point.
But that was the end.
He and I were friends, but as far as families, I don't recall.
But I mean, you and he were friends after that day?
No.
Wow.
No. And that, I think, was the beginning of my fear of black people, which I still have a problem with. I don't hold any animosity toward black people, but I do fear.
Those experiences we have as young kids carry a heavy weight all through our lives, right?
Especially when we take it alone.
Yeah.
At that age.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way to process it, to address it.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for sharing. Anybody else? Yeah.
I moved to Libya, North Africa, when I was 13. And the first day of school, one of my classmates, American classmates, walked up to me and she said, "Don't you hate the Mo's?" Well, I didn't know what she meant. And I was too embarrassed to say, you know, I didn't know what she meant, but she was talking about the local Arab Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And that was eventually, you know, what I learned, but it certainly has stood out in my mind that she wanted to teach me that this is how I should feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think when in times of warfare and so on, that sort of thing is brilliantly manipulated. You know, we call them gooks, and they're easier to kill. My friend served in Desert Storm, and they were fighting towel heads. or LBGs, little brown guys. You know, because when you use that language, you dehumanize them, and it's easier to shoot someone who's been dehumanized.
In the 1800s, we dehumanized the Native Americans, and the military went in and murdered thousands of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's easier to do that when they become...
That took over their land, conveniently.
Yeah, conveniently. You had your hand up.
Yes. I remember sometime in elementary school, I had a group of friends that was, you know, until the issue of race came up, we were all just friends. Mm-hmm. And the issue of race came up as we were playing basketball one day, and then suddenly there were some black people in the group and some white people in the group. But until then, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one day when we were playing basketball during recess, and a black boy suggested, you know, let's do blacks versus whites.
Mm.
And another black boy said, that's racist, or something like that, and, you know, and refused to have the game played that way. So we didn't do it that way. But that, ever since that happened, or rather, I would say that day, just to put it on that day, that group of friends was suddenly, you know, black and white.
The elephant was in the room.
Yeah.
And, yeah. It's interesting. And I think it becomes really difficult when it never goes beyond that. Because now all of a sudden there's this thing, right? And then if people are like, well, we don't want to talk about that thing, but we know that thing is there, you can't ever sort of get past that hump. And but that's a hard thing to do.
And I could see it, you know, from around that time, I would say this was probably third grade. And I could see from like around that time, people were starting to identify more with their race, you know, which we've established as a social construct. But people were beginning to identify more with their race, and, you know, everybody's egos were developing along those lines, and I remember noticing that around that time, yeah.
Yeah. We're running out of time. I just want to share one last thing. When we were in D.C., we did 50 of these stories, and I just remember, you know, and it was... it was powerful to sit with all of those people and hear those things. People had been really honest and shared some very personal stories. But I just remember then when we packed up and we drove away through D.C., I'd see these families walking together, a mom holding, you know, African-American mom holding her kid's hand. And so many of these stories say, you know, on the playground when I was in kindergarten, when I was in first grade. And I just kept thinking to myself, at what point in that child's life is someone going to tell them that they're not good enough, they don't matter? At what point is that going to click in their mind, and what does that mean for how they're going to grow up? So I will just leave you with the thought of what does our faith call us to do in those sort of situations. Thank you guys for coming. It's been a fun week for me.